This is Central Time. Wisconsin Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Evers delivered his annual address to the state legislature yesterday with a political backstory behind it and a critical message directed at the governor and lawmakers.
On school funding, we must face the reality that for too many budget cycles, public school funding has not been a priority of those in control.
Also this week, Governor Walker signed the state budget into law after making 99 vetoes.
It allows us to protect public safety and public health while still protecting the local taxpayer. It invests big time in the student success for all of you. It invests for all of our citizens in being more digitally connected here and across the state. It invests in our roads and in our bridges.
Laurel White joins us now for our weekly review of Wisconsin news. She's WPR's state capitol reporter. Laurel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with Tony Evers, his annual State of Education address yesterday. This one was a little different because he's running for governor in a growing Democratic primary field. Did that make the speech a little different than it was in past years?
It did. So he hit on a theme that he has consistently as superintendent of schools. He's been superintendent since 2009. He talked about needing more money for K-12 education in Wisconsin. That's a consistent message for him. He's advocated for a new funding formula for Wisconsin schools. We heard that clip that you guys played at the top of the segment there where he's saying that it just hasn't been a priority for lawmakers. And he talked about some of the referendums that have passed in communities across Wisconsin to raise property taxes to get more money for schools. So that's something that we kind of expected him to do. There were a couple things, though, that were a little bit more political, perhaps indications or symptoms maybe of him running as a Democrat for governor. He announced that earlier this summer. He talked about the state transportation budget, and he talked about how he thinks that there's too much borrowing in the transportation budget that puts too much of a burden on future generations. And he pushed for a new revenue source for Wisconsin roads, which is something that was, of course, a big sticking point in the ongoing transportation debate. And he said after the speech that he would support, if he were elected governor, something like a gas tax increase to get more money for roads. And he tied it to education, saying, you know, if we have a new source of revenue for roads, we don't have to shift money away from schools to pay for roads. So there were certainly some political elements to his speech this year that weren't necessarily there in the past.
Now, Governor Walker has talked about restoring a good chunk of money to education in the state. What did Superintendent Evers say about the state budget and its education funding levels?
Mm-hmm. Well, the governor signed into law yesterday a $636 million funding increase for K-12 schools in Wisconsin. So he's calling that a historic investment in schools. And essentially what Superintendent Evers said was, it's not enough. I think in remarks after the speech, when he was speaking with reporters, he said, we're essentially treading water in the state of Wisconsin. We're not keeping up with our peers in the Midwest and states across the country in terms of how much money we're investing into education and how much that money is growing year over year.
And with Superintendent Evers talking about changing the school funding formula, I mean, I think it's fair to say, probably the most complicated part of state government in Wisconsin is the mm-hmm. way schools are funded. This is not something that's quick and easy to explain maybe at a campaign stop.
No, it's certainly not. I think it's one of the most complicated things. And Evers, interestingly, talked a little bit about how more community members and people across Wisconsin are learning more about that funding formula as they pass these referendums to raise their own property taxes to pay for schools. So he said that that's a knowledge that's increasing across Wisconsin. So maybe he's optimistic about making that a big part of his message as a Democrat running for governor.
We've already touched on Governor Walker's budget signing earlier this week. Let's dig a little further into that. Laurel White's with us, WPR State Capitol reporter. Governor Walker issued 99 vetoes in this budget. Has there been any reaction to some of the bigger changes he made?
Well, how long do we have?
99's a lot, yeah.
99's a lot, and there's been a lot of reaction. So I think the big one, Rob, is the the limit on revenue for schools, kind of sticking with the school subject, the governor vetoed something that was really important, particularly to Assembly Republicans, and that was lifting a revenue limit for low-spending schools in Wisconsin.
And what does that mean exactly? Again, school funding, complicated. What kind of schools are affected by that?
So these are schools, I think it's about 200 districts across the state of Wisconsin. That's a number from Representative John Nygren, who's co-chair of the Finance Committee, spend less than the state average on per pupil. So that makes them a low spending school. And what this legislation, what this piece of the budget would have done, would have lifted a state cap on spending specifically for those schools. So the state cap right now per pupil by law is $9,100. And you can go over that if you pass a referendum in your community. But if you don't, you're held to that amount. In the budget, it would have lifted that cap from $9,100 gradually, I believe, to $9,400 over the course of the budget and then beyond, even higher, in kind of a stair step. And proponents of that plan said it would equalize funding across communities in Wisconsin. They say that there are some districts that are spending quite a bit more than others per pupil, and that lifting the cap would kind of help even the playing field for all students in the state.
We're talking to WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White, looking at some of the top stories in Wisconsin news.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What issues have you been watching in the state budget? What were you hoping to see when it comes to transportation and also school funding? And what do you think of Wisconsin's right to work law? You can call us at 800-642-1234.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we continue our conversation right now with Laurel White, looking at the week in Wisconsin news.
And Laurel, wrapping up on the budget and the budget vetoes, we were talking about those low-spending schools. You mentioned what supporters were saying about why they wanted that extra funding in the budget. What was the case Governor Walker made for vetoing that?
Well, basically what the governor said about that veto was several school districts that would have been affected by that, the low-spending school districts, had tried to pass referendums in recent years to raise more money from property taxes, and those referendums hadn't passed. So the governor says that it should really be a matter of voter input, the property tax increases for schools. And so he says, you know, I welcome communities across the state to have referendums if they want to do so. But if this had remained in the budget, it would have raised property taxes for some communities without their consent. And property taxes were very important to the governor in this budget. So he zeroed out that item.
Moving on from the budget, Laurel, a right-to-work court ruling in a Wisconsin appeals court upheld a Wisconsin's right-to-work law. Good news there for Governor Walker and other supporters of that legislation. What was involved in this court case?
So this was a ruling by the state's Third District Court of Appeals, and it overturned, actually, a Dane County judge's ruling from last year. And essentially, the case was about unions being compelled to represent members who don't pay dues. So the unions, the right to work law, for those who aren't familiar, it bars mandatory dues at private sector businesses. So unions say, if we can't require people to pay dues, but we still have to represent them in negotiations and doing the things that we do, essentially we're providing a free service, and that's unconstitutional. So last year, the Dane County judge said, that's a good argument, unions, I agree with you. The case was appealed, and the Third District Court of Appeals overturned the Dane County judge's ruling this week and said unions didn't have a valid argument in their decision. They actually said, quote, the unions have no constitutional entitlement to the fees of non-member employees. So this was definitely an important development in the right to work debate, which has been ongoing since the law was signed in 2015.
And do we know if there's going to be an appeal on this one?
I think it's probably safe to say that there will be an appeal on this one, and that the court battle will continue, potentially, you know, up to the state Supreme Court.
And probably, given the makeup of the court, I would imagine that most people would expect that the state Supreme Court would uphold the right to work law.
That's right. I mean, the state Supreme Court has a 5-2 conservative majority. So I think that folks imagine if it gets to the Supreme Court, the right to work law will be upheld there. And we did, interestingly, get some feedback from both the governor and the state attorney general this week after this ruling was issued. And they said that they both obviously still stand behind the law and its constitutionality.
And then in the legislature, Gordon Hintz is now the new assembly minority leader for the Democrats. Had anybody else put their name in the hat for that position?
Nope. It was just Gordon Hintz, who's from Oshkosh, running to replace Democrat Peter Barca of Kenosha, who's been the minority leader for Democrats in the assembly since 2011.
And what has Gordon Hintz said about his agenda for basically a powerless group of Democrats? They've got a minority. They're not really even close there right now.
They do. Yeah. So Democrats are, their number is 35 to the 64 Republicans in the state assembly. So they have a very small minority in that legislative body. It's the smallest it's been, I think, since the 1950s. So Hintz has his work cut out for him, really. He's leading that group now, and he says he's really going to be focused on having a clear message from the Assembly Democratic Caucus, clear priorities, and a kind of unity, I think, was another big point, you know, presenting a unified, clear, consistent message to the people of Wisconsin about what Democrats can do for them.
And Laurel, as we wrap up, there's been so much talk about the budget lately and Foxconn. Those are now done as far as the legislature's role in them. What do you see coming out as priorities now that those are out of the way?
Well, it's going to be really interesting to keep an eye on what was vetoed out of the state budget that might reappear as standalone legislation. That's something that the governor actually mentioned in his veto message for a piece of the budget that was about local regulation of quarries. He said he vetoed that because he thinks it should be its own bill and go through the legislative process. So we'll certainly be keeping an eye out for that in particular. There are, of course, some other bills that we have our eye on. I know I spoke with you guys earlier this week about the concealed carry changes in the state of Wisconsin. So we've got an eye on that, and we're expecting both the Senate and the Assembly to come back in late October to hit the floor and pass some more bills.
Laurel, thanks. Good to talk to you again.
Yep. Thanks, Rob.
That's WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White rounding up the top stories in Wisconsin news. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. According to a recent Gallup poll, half of Americans say they were unengaged at work, and many of those unengaged workers said they were looking for a reason to care again.
Engagement is part of what goes into the secret sauce of workplace happiness. Our next guest says we have a right to be happy at work. We spend sometimes upwards of 40 hours each week of our life at work, so happiness matters. And things like friendly relationships, a sense of purpose, and a sense of hope can make a big difference.
Annie McKee is a senior fellow at the University of Pennsylvania. Her latest book is called How to Be Happy at Work, The Power of Purpose, Hope, and Friendship. Annie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much, Veronica and Rob.
Well, Annie, huge numbers of people say they are unhappy at work or they're unengaged. Why do you think that number is so high?
I think there are a lot of reasons that so many people are unhappy and some are downright miserable at work. Number one, somehow we've come to believe that we don't deserve to be happy at work, and that's flat out wrong. Of course we do. As you said, Rob, we spend upwards of a third of our waking lives at work, and if we waste that time in misery, then life, of course, is going to be unhappy as well. So that's number one. Number two, the reality is we're under a lot of pressure in our workplaces, 24/7, always on. It's really hard sometimes to dial it back. And third, sometimes we don't take responsibility for our own happiness and we point fingers or blame or expect somebody to give it to us.
Well, looking at the expectations we have, I mean, it is called work, and work by definition is not play, it's work. You know, it's something that you have to exert effort at. So do you think that, like you were saying, some of us feel like this isn't what work is for? You don't go to work to be happy, you go to work to make money.
Yeah, I think actually we do go to work to become fulfilled. If you think back to that first job or getting ready to take a job in, after college, or maybe even the second job, we're always excited about doing something important, and we want to have impact on something that we care about, and most of us do that through our work, or at least we try to. So this notion that it's just a job and we're doing it to get money so we can be happy in the rest of our lives, research does not bear that out. First of all, money's important, of course. Ask anybody who doesn't have any. And I've been in situations in my life where I didn't have enough, and it's not good. But once we've got enough to make ends meet, to take care of our families, it doesn't satisfy us. We need more.
And how do we get there? How do we get from being someone who might be unengaged at the one level and on another? Maybe we're just flat out miserable.
It starts with emotional intelligence, and in fact, it starts with self-awareness. We need to take time out to reflect, to think, to really kind of dig deep and ask the question, what matters to me? What are my values, and how can I live those values at work? What do I care about? How do I want to have impact on work, and how can I do more of that in my workplace? And by the way, it's not just people with jobs in noble professions like, you know, working as a physician or maybe working for an organization that provides aid in some part of the world that provides fulfillment. Research shows that we can find fulfillment no matter what we do. It's about mindset, and it's about looking at our work to find ways to live our values and to have impact.
Can you tell a story about that? How might that play out with someone?
Sure. I'll tell you two quick stories. One, research done by Amy Rusnewski at Yale is really interesting. She studied janitors in hospitals and other places, and you might say, oh boy, that's a hard job to really love and feel happy about. But she found that people who were doing that work, who saw their work as a way to provide for a healthy environment for patients and their families, really truly did feel fulfilled and happy on the job. In my own experience, in my early life, I had all sorts of jobs, you know, community organizing, cleaning people's houses, and this wasn't just to get through college. It was, unfortunately, a way of life for a while. And, you know, I was pretty down for a while, but I found, too, that when I directed my attention toward figuring out, A, what I was good at in these jobs, and then, B, how I could maximize my own enjoyment, and for me, it was getting to know some of the people that I worked with.
And speaking of knowing the people that you work with, that's a big one on your list. You say you need to have sort of your people, your tribe at work, and it doesn't pay to go in and just keep to yourself.
We've always been told, I think, that you're not supposed to have friends at work, that if you have friends, especially if you're a manager, your judgment will be clouded. And it is true that you have to be able to separate, especially when you have to have hard conversations and make decisions that affect people. But similarly, if you don't understand people, if you don't know what motivates them, if you don't know where they're coming from or what they care about or what they want to do, your judgment will be clouded there too. So I say let's throw out the myth that we don't need friends at work. We actually do. We spend 8, 9, 10 hours a day, and if we don't like the people in our workplace, chances are we're not getting up excited to go there. We've got to make a shift.
Do you think that these friends are on par with the friends in the other areas, the non-work areas of our life? Or should we, I mean, does it make sense to hold something back so you're not sharing all the personal details of your life with the people you work with? Or should you just go all in?
That's a great question. I don't think friendships at work have to be fraught with every single personal detail or every conflict you're experiencing in the rest of your lives. It does, however, require us to go a little bit beyond where most of us are in the workplace and learn to read people accurately, learn to understand what motivates them, learn to understand what they care about, learn to understand what values are important to them. And frankly, yes, we do need to find out a little bit about what they care about outside of work. But there's another way to get to know people and become friendly at work, and that's around the work itself. When we do something together collaboratively and we've got shared goals and we share why that work is important to us, why those goals are important to us, bonds form. And that's where you start feeling like we're in it together, that feeling of belonging, that feeling of companionship that is so important in friendships and work.
So if we're thinking about this on an individual level, it all makes sense. Everyone, it seems like, wants to be happier, but why should our bosses have anything at stake? Why should they care if we're happy?
Another great question. The reason our bosses ought to care about how we feel about the workplace and whether we're happy or not is because our feelings impact how we think. Our feelings impact the functioning of our brains. And if we want to be smart, then we've got to tend to how we feel in the workplace. Research in neuroscience and psychology show that when we're negative and cynical and scared and angry and frustrated, our brains literally shut down. And on the opposite side, when we're largely enthusiastic, optimistic, have an appropriate amount of stress but not too much, our brains open up and we can take in more information, we make better decisions, we're more creative. So in the end, organizations are more successful when people are happy, just as individuals are more successful too.
Now, do you think that anyone in any job could be happier, or do you think there are some jobs that are just clunkers and you got to get out?
The research shows that people can find happiness in jobs that you would not expect we could find happiness. I do think there's a limit, however. I think when working conditions are inhumane, and I'm not talking about in extreme inhumanity that we might have think about when we think back on the Industrial Revolution and sweatshops and all that sort of thing, which, by the way, still exists today. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about workplaces where you're literally tied to your desk, or, you know, you can't even get up to use the restroom, that sort of thing. It is very hard, I think, to be happy when we can't meet our basic physical needs. Short of that, however, I think really truly we need to take charge of happiness and not wait for all of the problems in our workplaces to be fixed. They're not going to all be fixed. We will have those bosses we don't like. The cultures aren't always perfect in our workplace, and sometimes the workload is a little too heavy. So we have to look inside ourselves and see how we can shift our mindset, dig deep using self-awareness, that wonderful skill of self-awareness, to figure out what it is that matters to us, and then manage ourselves so that we direct our attention to what's important, that we stay optimistic, and we make choices about how do we spend our time.
Right, and you say, as you were getting at there, that happiness is a choice. And so let's say someone's listening now, and they are that person who's just miserable in their job. What are two or three solid steps that they can take to get to a better place?
First of all, if you're listening now and you haven't been happy in your job for a while, or there's some situations at work that are really making you unhappy or discontented, the first thing you can do is to take some time and really try to look objectively at what's going on. Is your boss really a demon? Is he really evil? Is she really horrible? Or is that person experiencing some stress from their boss that maybe you don't see every day? Taking a little bit more realistic look at what's happening in the workplace is a great first step. Number two, try to remember what you liked about the job in the first place, and then look around and see if there are more opportunities to do more of that. What I find is that we often box ourselves in pretty well in the workplace, and we think we don't have very much power in terms of what we do or how we spend our time or the projects we get involved in. In fact, my experience with the folks that I've worked with, and even my own personal experience, is if we know what we're asking for and if we know why, we can often find more opportunities to do more of what we like.
And what if it's not in our job description? And so we go, okay, well, that's not what I'm hired to do. So, you know, the boss is just going to say no.
Well, will the boss say no? It's not always the case, actually. I think it's worth a try. Now, mind you, you've got to be really careful when you're approaching a boss to ask to do something different that's outside of our job description. We've got to make sure that it's somewhat realistic, that the work actually needs to be done, that in some way it will help the boss and help the organization. Do an analysis. But no, if what you want to do is going to help others, especially your boss, especially those around your boss, then, you know, you might have a shot at it.
And Annie, as we wrap up, you also say if you're unhappy and you're overworked and you're stressed, go ahead and eat lunch and don't do it in the office.
Take time for yourself. Eat lunch. Take a walk. Get out of there. It's Friday afternoon, Friday evening right now. Look forward to that weekend. We can't love our jobs if that's all we do.
Annie, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Annie McKee is a senior fellow at the University of Pennsylvania. Her latest book is called How to Be Happy at Work, The Power of Purpose, Hope, and Friendship.